Welcome once again to our 30th in a series of Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology, which is in the letter of St. Peter. He said, Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and reverence. That's what we're trying in our series, Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, to do. Give logical reasons why we believe in God, why we believe in Jesus as God made man, why we believe in the church as set up by Jesus, visible church organization to teach in his name down through the 20 centuries until the end of time. So we just finished quite a few things about the popes, the head of the church, or the successor of St. Peter, who was the first pope and the longest reigning of the popes. Now we're getting into the apostolic fathers or the apostolic writers. And Ron, you might want to say a word about the apostolic writers, because they're not the apostles.
I want to tie this in with the last session where we left off by stressing the continuity between the apostles, the first popes, and the early church fathers. When any informed Catholic reads the early church fathers, especially the apostolic fathers, who personally knew the apostles, or men who studied under them,
okay,
such as St. Clement of Rome, who became the fourth pope, we mentioned him yesterday, or our last session, as the third successor to St. Peter, St. Polycarp, St. Ignatius of Antioch, St. Justin Martyr, and St. Irenaeus. Any Catholic would easily recognize in their writings their description of the sacraments, especially the Mass, the principal doctrines and ecclesiology, that is, the church government organized in a hierarchical structure of bishops, priests, deacons, and laity. And all of them died martyrs, as did thousands of Christians during the first 3 centuries A.D. Of their martyrdom, Tertullian, who was one of the early theologians.
He died around 254 or something like that.
And he said, quote, the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. I've heard other quotes, the blood of martyrs is the seed of Christians, so either one. And after a careful study of early church history, especially the church fathers, including the apostolic fathers, John Henry Newman once wrote something to the effect that one couldn't have knowledge of history without coming to the conclusion the Catholic Church is the true church, the one, of course, established by Jesus himself. And while it has been said of numerous intellectuals that they read themselves into the church, it has been said that Newman, wrote himself into the church. He was already a very prominent scripture scholar and theologian as an Anglican, high church Anglican, before he came into the Catholic Church in 1845.
Is that when he came in, 1845?
Yes,
I was just going to ask you, what's the time for Newman? Because he's reasonably close to us.
Yes, in fact, toward the end of his life, well, I think in 78, 1878 or so, Leo the 13th, the Pope, because of the contributions he had made to Catholic theology, raised him to the cardinalate. In other words, made him a cardinal.
In England. Okay. Who else besides our apostolic are among the apostolic writers of the church?
Well, I'd like to say a little bit about St. Clement of Rome. He was one of the first in time of the apostolic fathers. And according to Roman Catholic tradition, he is considered to be the fourth pope, as well as one of the apostolic fathers. And the church claims that he was ordained by St. Peter himself. Peter, of course, was the bishop of Rome during that time.
He was ordained bishop.
Yes.
Okay.
He probably was a freedman of Titus Flavius Clemens, who was consul with his cousin Domitian. Domitian later on became the emperor, and so obviously he was a very high-placed man. And it is believed that his brother was Hermas, and who wrote The Shepherd of Hermas, one of the most famous of the Orthodox early church writings. In fact, I understand it was one work that was actually considered as that's a possibility for the canon.
Oh, really?
Of the New Testament, but was not included. Also, another work that they, I understand, considered as a possibility for the canon was the Didache.
Okay, teaching of the 12 apostles.
Yes, sometimes this is called the Catechism of the 12 apostles.
Okay.
St. Clement stands out amongst early popes because of his letter to the church at Corinth, written about 96 A.D., at the end of the reign of Domitian, Emperor Domitian, and the letter was occasioned by a dispute in Corinth, which had led to the removal from office of some several priests. And this letter is the first recorded instance that has come down to us of a pope asserting his primacy over other local churches in the Catholic Church at that time. So before the first century was over,
there was evidence that people were appealing to and listening to the successor of St. Peter.
Yes, of a pope is asserting his authority, but also you'll read in some other sources of other bishops and other Christians, leading Christians, who are recognizing the pope as the head of the church, as Christ's vicar on earth.
So this is before the year 100 ends.
Yes.
So right towards the end of the second century.
Yes.
Okay. Well, there are some other famous, even martyrs. What about St. Polycarp?
Well, St. Polycarp lived A.D. 69 to about 155. And the main sources of information about him, the epistles of St. Ignatius is one source, his own epistle to the Philippians, several passages in St. Irenaeus, and a letter of the Smyrnians telling the story of his martyrdom. And just as St. John's long life had lengthened the apostolic age to the end of the first century, because John didn't die till about the end of the century, or maybe even into the second century.
Okay.
So did the 87 years of Polycarp extend what has been called the age of the apostolic fathers to the mid-second century, because he didn't die until 155. And so from the time of Christ, people who had known Christ actually extended all the way up in up until the mid of the mid-second century.
So what you're saying, as Cardinal Newman had said, that if anybody reads these early writers of the church, they're going to see that the church is clearly up and running, and that it's the same structure that we have and the same teachings that we have today, 2,000 years later.
That's true. It was during the age of the apostolic fathers that one could still learn by word of mouth from those who had heard the apostles, and of course the apostles in turn, Jesus himself, teach.
Okay, so they're called apostolic fathers because they are leaders, are bishops and the like, are prominent leaders of the church who are extremely close to the apostles.
Yes.
Either heard them, or they talked to people who had talked to the apostles.
Or they were ordained by them,
okay,
or trained by them, or whatever.
So that's one of the things that convinced Cardinal Newman in reading these early writers that, well, they're saying the same thing that the Catholic Church was saying in the 19th century.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
Polycarp was a Christian bishop of Smyrna, which is now the town of Izmir, in Turkey. And Eusebius, the church historian that we mentioned a while ago, or maybe it was in the last session, he maintains that Polycarp had been a disciple of the Apostle John, the son of Zebedee.
Wow.
And he played an important role in the history of the early church and is among the earliest Christians' writings that have come down to us. He wasn't a philosopher or a theologian. He appears to have been a very practical leader and a very gifted teacher. St. Irenaeus, who we're going to be talking about a little bit, who remembered him from his youth, actually knew him personally, said he was a man, quote, a man who was of much greater weight and a more steadfast witness of truth than Valentinus and Marcion and the rest of the heretics. Because this is Irenaeus writing against heretics, of course, here.
Okay, now Marcion was the one who wanted to get rid of the Old Testament,
yes,
as not inspired. How about Valentinus? I don't recognize him.
Oh, Valentinius, sometimes it's pronounced. He was one of the leading Gnostic Christians of that time. In fact, he almost became a pope one time.
Really? Well, and we use this word continually through many of our talks, Gnostic, and we're going to talk about it when we talk about the Da Vinci Code. What is a good definition of Gnostic?
Well, that's hard. That's very hard. It's even debated amongst the scholars as to exactly what it is. So
it's kind of like smoke trying to hold it.
I could say a few things about it, but then that wouldn't really give a very clear
But it
picture.
Usually is involved with elite people who have secret knowledge that nobody else has, and that they're really the ones who are able to follow Jesus and not
yes.
other people.
We're going to pursue that in some considerable detail.
Okay.
When we answer the false claims that Dan Brown's made in the Da Vinci Code in our next series, which we'll be starting to record here pretty shortly.
Okay.
But Irenaeus, of course, was refuting the heretics who claimed to possess this secret knowledge you were just speaking of there, of the Gnostic type derived from the apostles, and at least they claim it was derived from the apostles,
sure.
of course. And to whom, and this is Irenaeus here quoting, quote, to whom, he demands, would the apostles be more likely to commit hidden mysteries than to the bishops to whom they entrusted their churches? In order then to know where the apostles taught, we must have recourse to the successors of the bishops throughout the world. End of quote. This is Irenaeus, of course, talking. And then he goes on to list the bishops of Rome, or the popes, down to the 12th, from the apostles, the last being Eleutherius.
That's a tough name.
Yes, that's a tough one to get out. All of whom he claims, this is Irenaeus claiming, had seen and conversed with the apostles. And regarding Polycarp, he says, quote, he was not only taught by the apostles and lived in familiar intercourse with many that had seen Christ, but also received his appointment in Asia from the apostles as bishop in the church of Smyrna, end of quote. And then he goes on to tell us his own personal acquaintance with Polycarp. So in conclusion, St. Polycarp lived at a time when several interpretations of the life and sayings of Jesus were being preached, and many of these were false teachings, these Gnostic type of heresies. And because of his reputation as a disciple who was connected with the Apostle John, he played the role of authenticating the teachings of the early church. And he himself, of course, was martyred for his unwavering faith in his 87th year.
There we had to translate in Greek in the seminary of the martyrdom of St. Polycarp, and he talks about that he was given the opportunity to feign throwing incense before the statue of Caesar, and they would let him go. And he said, I couldn't possibly do that. I'm paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm.
and I sure don't remember the Greek, but I couldn't possibly do that because of the effect that would have on all the younger people who would say that even in my old age, I gave in and was disloyal to my Lord and Master Jesus. So Polycarp shows us that he died in 155, I think.
Yes,
you said.
Yes, 155.
Okay. They were dealing with all sorts of crazy notions about who Jesus was and what he was teaching. That the Gnostics, as we'll talk about in the Da Vinci Code, That wasn't something just to our time. That was way back then, and the church was trying to clarify, now, here's the real Jesus, and here's his real teachings. And there seems to be something really attractive to most of us, including myself, that, boy, if I can get some secret knowledge that nobody else knows, boy, that's really going to make me outstanding. And I think that's one of the appeals of Gnosticism.
Yeah, it is, and it's what makes people feel important.
Yeah, I'm really one
yes.
one of the people who...
The elite.
Yeah, elite and all these other peasants can't follow the teachings of Jesus. And actually, in the first centuries of Rome, it was mostly the peasants and the slaves and the underdogs in society who first came en masse and followers of Jesus.
That's true.
Of course, some notables too, but by and large, it was their religion of slaves and people who had no material wealth at all. Okay, well, now there's another famous man, Saint Ignatius of Antioch. What can you tell us about him? Because he really is famous. I believe he died in the Roman Colosseum, eaten by the lions.
That's true, he was. He was born in Syria around the year 50 in the first century. In other words, Christ himself hadn't been dead for 16, 17, you know, years when St. Ignatius was born. And he was martyred in at Rome somewhere between 98, they don't know exactly when. I've read estimates all the way through to the year 117, so that's a 19-year span there, and they're just not sure exactly when he was martyred. But according to Eusebius,
the father of church history,
Eusebius of Caesarea, he was the third bishop or patriarch of Antioch in Syria. After
now, when you call him patriarch, isn't that the name they still use? They don't use the name bishop. They use the word patriarch. It's kind of like an archbishop,
yes.
Somebody special.
It's the same meaning, though. It's a bishop, really.
Okay.
And it's believed that Peter was actually the first bishop of Antioch before he moved on to Rome.
Okay.
And then a man by the name of Evodius. And then it's believed that Ignatius took his place. In fact, Theodoret, bishop of Cyrus, who was a theologian and church historian in the early 5th century, said that Peter himself appointed Ignatius to the See of Antioch.
Wow.
And it's also probable that he was a disciple of St. John, the apostle. St. Ignatius was one of the apostolic fathers, in other words. Eventually, he was arrested by the Roman authorities during the pontificate of Sixtus I and the reign of Emperor Trajan.
Okay, now, and I believe, and maybe you're going to cover this, but he wrote several letters on his way to martyrdom at the Roman amphitheater, and he kept saying to the people through whose cities they were passing, don't try to rescue me. I want to go and die for Jesus. I want to be, I think he said, I want to be wheat that's ground in the mouth of the lions because that could be the greatest thing that happened to me.
That's a fascinating story, that journey of his. It's one of the most famous journeys, I suppose, that ever happened in the history of the world. I'll tell a little bit about that. After his victory over the Scythians and the Dacians, or the Dacians, during the ninth year of as emperor, Trajan decreed, for the sake of unity, that the Christians should worship the gods with their pagan neighbors. And the Christians were threatened with death if they refused to offer the prescribed sacrifice. As you said a while ago, they could do it like Polycarp, if you want to do it insincerely. We don't care, as long as you throw the incense here, you know, on the altar and or into the fire or whatever, and then go on and worship as you want. But nonetheless, Ignatius did everything he could to defeat the emperor's order, because keep in mind he was the patriarch or the bishop there in Antioch. But he was soon arrested and taken before Trajan himself, who happened to be in Antioch at the time. Ignatius tried to defend himself and all Christians, but to no avail. And the emperor himself accused him of violating the imperial edict and of inciting others to do the same, and ordered him to be sent in chains to Rome to be fed to the wild beast in the arena. Trajan had hoped, of course, to make an example of him and thus discourage Christianity from spreading. But instead, it backfired on him. As Ignatius made this trip to Rome, it probably took, you know, a month or two before he actually got there.
And he was in his chains.
Yeah, in his chains. He was met by Christians along the way who flocked to meet him with encouragement all along the route. And you mentioned a while ago, it was during this journey that he wrote six letters to the various churches in the region, and one to to a fellow bishop. And of course, he eventually, we don't have any actual story when he was driven into the arena and eaten up by the lions or whatever else. But nonetheless, he did die a martyr in the Roman, at the circus, I think, in Rome. They didn't have the Colosseum. It wasn't built yet, I don't believe.
Oh, okay. Well, weren't there several Colosseums?
Well, there was
a couple of them.
There was one, but they had the circus before that.
The Roman circus.
The Roman circus, and that's where the gladiatorial contest and where all that kind of thing took place until they actually did build. One of the emperors had the Colosseum.
The Great Colosseum. Okay, how about the person who was what we're trying to be, an apologist for the early Christian church, the early Catholic church in the second century?
Well, one of the first, maybe the first, but certainly one of the first great apologists in the church, that is a defender of the faith, was Saint Justin Martyr. And he lived between 100 and 165 A.D., and he was a philosopher. Unlike Polycarp, who was a more practical, man of the people, Justin Martyr was would have been a great philosopher, a pagan philosopher. He hadn't become a Christian. And he studied philosophy, and then he converted to Christianity, after which he devoted the rest of his life teaching what he considered to be true philosophy. And after studying Christianity, it had been said that he was compelled to accept its irrefragable truth, its pure moral teaching, and to admire its superhuman constancy, end of quote. He probably traveled a great deal before ultimately settling in Rome as a Christian teacher, and he used to go to the various places where the philosophers would be and debate them. He was martyred at Rome under Emperor Marcus Aurelius, who was one of the greatest philosophers of his day.
You mean the emperor?
Yes, the emperor.
Yeah.
St. Anicetus was the reigning pope at the time, and his greatest work was the Dialogue, and then another one, the First Apology. He even named it Apology. Keeping in mind now, by apology, as we said at the beginning of this series, doesn't mean giving excuses for the faith. It means defending the faith.
Giving logical reasons why it makes sense.
Right. This apology was addressed to the emperor Antoninus Pius, either pronunciation, and his son Marcus Aurelius.
So he wrote directly to the emperor and his son?
He wrote directly to the emperor and his son. And his purpose in writing was to explain and defend the faith against the pagan critics. And one scholar has said that his role can be summed up in one word, a witness. He was a witness of the second century Catholic Church, about which he describes its faith, its life, and its worship. Marcus Aurelius is an interesting story. As I said, he was a very good man and a very good ruler in a lot of ways. During that time, there was a lot of bad Roman emperors, and he actually was one of the what they called the good emperors. Mm-hmm. But he was, and he didn't hate Christians, but I think he saw Christianity as a divisive force in his empire. And so he sought to do what he could to eradicate it, to destroy it.
Okay. So we just talked about Saint Justin, who was a martyr under Marcus Aurelius, and he may have been even the first Christian apologist, or at least one of the earliest.
Yes, he was one of the philosophers of the day. He was a genuine
professional philosopher. So he was a real intellectual.
Yes, a real intellectual. And he could debate these philosophers in Rome and on a one-to-one basis.
Sure. All right. Can we take another very famous early apologist of the Apostolic Fathers, St. Irenaeus?
Yes, he's the last one we're going to look at. He lived from 130 to 202 A.D. He was bishop of Lugdunum, Gaul, which is now Lyon, France. Although he isn't considered one of the church doctors, his writings were formative in the early development of Christian theology, and he's recognized as one of the fathers of the church. And he was a disciple of Polycarp, as we have established, who himself was a disciple of John the Evangelist, and is thought to have been a Greek from Smyrna in Asia Minor, now Izmir, Turkey. This was Polycarp's hometown. And he was raised a Christian, which probably explains his rigid orthodoxy. Irenaeus is credited with defending the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as being, inspired by the Holy Spirit and should be a part of the canon. In 170 AD, he stated in Against Heresies, his famous work against the heretics of his time, quote, "The heretics boast that they have many more Gospels than there really are. But really, they don't have any Gospels that aren't full of blasphemy. There actually are only four authentic Gospels," end of quote. And now, when we get into the Da Vinci Code, we'll be looking at that issue in some detail, because Dan Brown makes some claims about that are not correct about the establishment of the canon of the New Testament.
Okay, so in his Against the Heresies, or Adversus Heresis, St. Irenaeus is already talking about authentic and counterfeit Gospels. And
yes.
And this is in the year 170. So it's nothing new in the church to be talking about all kind of Gospels that really the church never accepted as authentic.
Well, in the Da Vinci Code, they talk about over 80 Gospels. Well, there really weren't that many, but there were a number of Gospels, probably maybe 15 or so, that were circulating at the time. And there are people like Elaine Pigalle will claim in her Gnostic Gospels that all of these Gospels were sort of on an equal plane at that time amongst Christians, and that there were different Christian groups all on sort of an equal plane, and that there wasn't any established institutional church that Jesus had established and anything like that. And as I said, we're going to lay those claims to rest.
Hopefully.
But I think we'll do a pretty good job.
What about this last paragraph here, because our time's running out on us. How about that? I think there's some important things in there about the Montanus heresy.
Well, Montanus was a convert to Christianity. He taught that his own prophecies superseded and fulfilled the doctrines proclaimed by the apostles, and that Christians who fell from grace could not be redeemed, and strongly emphasized the avoidance of sin, church discipline, but that's okay, of course, but and chastity. But he was so much against that that he forbid remarriage, or even discouraged even marrying. And, of course, this is a part of Gnosticism to some extent because of the dualism, and that the spiritual is good and the physical or the matter is evil and all that kind of thing, which, as I said, we'll get into that when we get into the Da Vinci Code. But
Actually, Irenaeus was refuting these kind of things.
Yes.
That existed even in his time, which was around 170.
That's correct.
Okay, you want to give that little summary down?
Well, upon returning to Gaul, Irenaeus, because he made a trip to Rome, and then when he came back to Gaul, or what is France today, he succeeded a man by the name of Pothinus. He became the bishop of Lyon, and the second bishop. And during this time, the Montanist and Gnostic heresies were at their height, and of course that's why he basically wrote his Against Heresies.
I've learned a lot in this talk, Ron. May God bless all our listeners always and in all ways.